This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. NASA officials said today that they've expanded the search for debris from the space shuttle Columbia. Wreckage apparently fell further west than they originally thought. They've set up a second collection point for what they found at what used to be Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth. The other is at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. They say they're still not sure where they will consolidate all the material they find. The highest priority right now, the official said, is the families of the people who were killed, and they're paying special attention to the search for human remains. A memorial service has been scheduled for tomorrow at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. The president and the first lady are expected to attend. But both NASA and the White House emphasize they expect space exploration to continue, so they will examine every bit of evidence, no matter how long that takes, to determine what went wrong and to fix it so it doesn't happen again. Starting today, NASA plans two briefings today, the first at headquarters here in Washington, then one later in the afternoon at the Johnson Space Flight Center. Later this hour, we'll hear from one of the former members of NASA's Safety Advisory Board, who was replaced a year ago as the panel raised long-term safety issues. We'll hear from space historian Andrew Chaikin and from two former astronauts. And we want to hear from you. What are your biggest questions? How do you feel NASA is handling this story? And what does the disaster mean for the future of the manned space program and for space exploration? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. There was not a great deal of news from today's first briefing, but here to parse what we learned is NPR science correspondent Joe Palca, who's with us here in Studio 3A. Joe, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
I know you've been putting in some long hours since this news first broke on Saturday. Let's recap what came out of the press conference. The debris field, as I mentioned just a moment ago, larger further west.
Yes, and I suppose we have to draw the conclusion from that perhaps the shuttle was breaking up further west. It was streaking across the sky from west to east toward the landing site in Florida, and so the further west the debris is, the earlier in the mission the shuttle started to break apart. So there was the debris field. The other thing we learned, which I guess has been known but was reemphasized today, is the shuttle is crucial for refueling and restoring and still building the International Space Station, which is on orbit. There are three crew members, two astronauts and one cosmonaut aboard the space station, and we heard today that they are safe, that their supplies, there's a new supply rocket on the way that will be delivering materials to the space station tomorrow, and that with that delivery, the astronauts and cosmonaut will be in good shape till late May or early June. So even though the shuttle flights, so the next one was supposed to go up in March to actually change over the crew, even though that won't happen, the crew is safe and will have material to live on for several more months. Apart from that, we learned some, certain sort of structural issues relating to the investigation. As you said, another collection point. We learned that a lot of the procedures that are being followed today are a direct result of the Challenger accident, because the William Rogers, you remember, former Secretary of State William P. Rogers chaired a commission that investigated the Challenger accident, and that commission recommended certain changes in the way NASA responded to catastrophic events, or in NASA speak, I think there was, what's the lingo, Neil? I forget.
Mishap.
A mishap, yes. A contingency, I think, is the word they use. So in this contingency, after it was declared, there were certain structural things that went into place. There was an external panel that was activated, that's sort of standing by, ready to go, and that's being chaired by Admiral Guillen, who's the same man who chaired a panel that looked into the accident on board the USS Cole. So that panel has begun to investigate. There are internal NASA panels that have begun to investigate, and there are commissions and bodies and groups and committees and what have you that are all standing by to go into the field and gather things from NASA centers and try to learn what they can about what caused this accident.
And I know you just misspoke. Obviously, it was not an accident aboard the USS Cole.
It was a bombing.
Yes.
Terribly sorry.
Over the weekend and into today, there's been continuing focus. I think one of the officials today said it looks like the leading suspect is damaged to the tiles.
Well, I think the key point here is that it's the leading candidate. He said, "I think that Associate Administrator Bill Reedy was very anxious to point out that in an accident investigation, you rule things out, you don't rule them in." And so there are a lot of things. NASA officials did see a piece of insulation. It's been called foam. But that sort of gives people the wrong impression about what it is. It was sprays on as foam. It's insulation that insulates the fuel tank, the external fuel tank to the shuttle. It sprays on as foam, but it hardens into a more brick-like substance. And a piece of that fell off. We think it was, they're estimating it was about 7 inches by 30 inches in dimension. It fell off and banged into the shuttle and perhaps dislodged some tile or perhaps damaged some tile. They think the cause of the accident that they're most concerned about is a thermal event, which suggests that the heat, these tiles are to prevent the heat of reentry from causing the ship to, the space shuttle from sort of burning up on reentry. It's somewhat analogous to the heat shields that the Apollo and Mercury and Gemini spacecraft used to use. But these heat tiles can take enormous heat without warming up very much. There's just amazing physical property of them. But they're also a little bit fragile, and a piece of this insulation falling on them on liftoff could have caused some damage. It could be just the one tile that happened to be in the one spot that was the worst spot to be damaged. They don't know. There's going to be a lot of looking into this.
Again, NASA promised a very wide-ranging, completely open investigation. But how... Tell us a little bit more about how it's going to take place. For example, what can they learn from the debris? Is this going to be like that investigation of the Pan Am flight that crashed over Lockerbie, where they painstakingly reassembled it shard by shard?
Well, they spoke about reassembling bits of the shuttle today. It does seem amazing that you could take this enormous a piece of equipment and put it back together, though again, I guess you can do that with a 747 or at least key parts of it. As not a trained observer or an expert in this matter, I'm always quite amazed that something that looks like a twisted piece of nothing, metal, can tell a story. But, you know, as I've read about this, the way it's twisted, the way it is charred on the outside sometimes tells you whether the piece came off from an external heat source or whether something was burning a hole from the inside. So there are, if you can identify the piece and know where it came from, and NASA can identify almost every piece of everything they send into space, a careful analysis of what they've got may help pinpoint the problem.
Joining us now from his office in Knoxville, Tennessee, is John Stewart. He's a former member of the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel, and he served on that board for over 20 years, from 1980 to 2001, and specialized in studies of NASA's workforce. And Mr. Stewart, thanks very much for joining us.
Neil, glad to be here. It's a sad business, but you all are asking the right questions.
Well, during the news conference earlier today, one of the NASA officials, General Kostelnik, said that, quote, safety in this system has not been driven by investments or funds, trust me. Would you agree with that?
Well, you know, it's not an easy question to answer because, you know, on the one hand, the NASA managers like Ron Dittamore, who's been very evident to the public the last couple of days, and people like that are very dedicated to their work and try very hard to do the best possible job and are remarkably competent people. They really are top people. NASA found itself in this very difficult situation between the rising costs and cost overruns and so forth of the space station and the need to keep the space shuttle as a safe operating vehicle. And so in recent years, our safety panel has been increasingly concerned over the fact that the funds that ought to be allocated, in our view, to upgrades of the aging space shuttle fleet and money that ought to go for maintaining a really top flight workforce at the various NASA centers, that money was ending up into the space station account. and because of their difficulties. And so the space shuttle people were having a very difficult time making things fit together in terms of their budget realities, and a lot of the upgrades that we had identified as necessary were not making it. They were being deferred, or they just weren't being done at all. And so, while none of us would say that the space shuttle was unsafe, all of us were worried that increasingly, the lack of these investments in terms of future operations, there was getting closer and closer to the edge of a situation which you were not comfortable with.
The New York Times headline said today, NASA dismissed advisors who warned about shuttle safety troubles. Is that a fair representation?
Well, I mean, it's true. We did warn about problems, and we had been doing that for a number of years, and there were a bunch of us who were, in fact, dismissed. I guess that's a fair word. Now, the question is not whether that's a true headline, but whether there's a link between those two things. And I simply don't know whether there is or not. And I've never alleged that there was. We'd been there a long time. It was time to get some new faces on the panel, and we had also been critical of things that were not happening that we thought ought to happen. I certainly am not prepared to make the statement that we were dismissed because we were saying things that NASA didn't want to hear. A lot of folks would like me to say that, and I've had a number of calls today with folks trying to get me to say that, but I don't think that would be an accurate thing for me to say. Let me try to say it in a different way that maybe might be helpful. The kind of concerns that we were raising in our reports, and we've been doing this for a number of years now, those sorts of concerns are very relevant and very important once the shuttle gets back to flying again. Because the issue is this system going to be safe 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and what we believe would be more than 15 years from now, that the shuttle is still going to be our only manned flight vehicle. Are the investments being made to achieve safety in that kind of time frame? I don't think there's much of what we were involved in that's going to relate one way or another to the Columbia investigations, but it's going to be very relevant once the fleet is no longer grounded. I don't know if that helps or not.
Well, it does. Mr. Stewart, it's Joe Palka here. My question was really whether or not you saw any of those changes that you were recommending being adopted after you left. I mean, is it possible that the new board was being more aggressive in some way, the panel members who replaced you?
Yeah. I think that, it's really too early to tell, I guess. And, I've not stayed in close touch with what the panel's been doing. And the report, see, we were interrupted right in the middle. That's the other thing that was peculiar, is that we were halfway sort of through our annual work cycle where we were doing investigations and making recommendations and getting ready to do our annual report to the administrator. And we were sort of halfway through that cycle when we were all asked to leave. And it would have been much more effective, I think, and sensible was to let us to finish out that cycle and then... A number of us, several of us anyway, were thinking of leaving anyway because we'd been there for so long. The fact that it happened in the middle of this has always struck me as strange, and I can't really explain it. In the scheme of things, it's not a big deal, but it's still strange.
Mr. Stewart, we hope you can stay with us through the break and answer a couple of listeners' questions.
Yeah, I can. I can be there, for another 10 or 15 minutes. It's been a busy day when you and your fellow news colleagues get on your trail, life can get very interesting.
I bet it can. I hope it never happens to me.
Yeah.
We will be back after a break. Joe Palka, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
NPR science correspondent Joe Palka. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. You can join in. Our phone number is 800-989-TALK or send us email, totn@npr.org. With us on the line is John Stewart, a former member of the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel. He's with us by phone from his office in Knoxville, Tennessee. And let's go right to listeners' questions. And our first caller is Gordon, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I just got a question on the engineering that's sending the space shuttle up, and they see something going wrong. Why don't they abort the thing before we start killing people of Americans? Why would we do that? I mean, if the engineer says, hey, we got something going wrong here, we have to abort, and then the NASA says, no, we're going to send them up. We got to make national history here. Well, you did. You killed seven people. Hmm. Why?
Mr. Stewart?
Yeah, well, I think that... I'm not aware of any instance where there was a known safety problem where NASA went ahead and launched anyway. I mean, the closest thing to that was the decisions that were made surrounding the launch of the Challenger back in 1986, and that was not one of NASA's finer hours. But since that time, and I think having benefited from that experience, I can point to literally dozens of times when launches have been postponed. Sometimes for very long periods of time, where NASA engineers were chasing down things that they did not understand and were not comfortable with. So I don't think NASA has ever knowingly launched a shuttle that they knew was unsafe, and I can't imagine they ever would.
Gordon, were you asking about aborting in mid-takeoff?
Yeah. Why? You know, if they had seen something maybe on mid-takeoff, you know, they were saying up here in the papers or something that there's something on the wing that was... Yeah. What
yep.
happened as they're going, or
this foam that may have hit the left wing?
Well, that's once you ignite the solid rocket boosters, there's no tomorrow. Those things are going. You can't shut them off. Now there are abort procedures that NASA has in place, but they are highly risky. I mean, you would only go to those when you were facing a known catastrophe, and you can There's a very tricky maneuver where you go around to the Kennedy Space Center and come back and land on that runway. That's very hard to do. Then there are other abort procedures where you land overseas in landing fields in Spain and in that general area.
Morocco sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
And what they saw, first of all, they didn't see it till a day after the launch. So that's point one. And then two, what they saw certainly was not in a category of anything like warranting an abort procedure, because the abort procedure would be more dangerous than proceeding at that point. So NASA is very committed to safety, and everybody better understand that. That's true. It really is true. And our concerns on our panel was not the near term. It was the longer term. As these shuttle vehicles continue to age and so on, what are the investments you need to make to ensure that safety to the degree which you can? And some of those investments were not being made, and that's what we were concerned about.
Gordon, thanks very much for the question.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Email question from Mukund Pai in Cleveland, Ohio. I was wondering if, as part of the investigation into this disaster, whether all correspondence between NASA engineers, past and present, and the Bush administration might have revealed a concern for just such a catastrophic scenario that was discussed, and whether warnings were ignored.
Well, who knows? I have no way of knowing that. I can only tell you from the context of our panel, you know, our concerns, and I think this is true for a lot of people in the space shuttle community, our concerns were much more focused on the ascent, taking off, because that's when you have all these highly energetic engines running, and the danger of catastrophic failure is much greater then than in the descent. And the descents have always been so, you don't want to use the word routine, because that would give you a misimpression, but they have always worked so well, they've always been executed so effectively, that we never, as a panel, spent hardly any time at all focusing on descent issues.
What do you suspect, and I guess the template we have to go back to is post-Challenger, but what do you think is going to happen now? I mean, do you think the workforce is going to be expanded, that some of these upgrades which you're talking about may be implemented?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot will depend on what the investigation reveals, obviously. One of the things, a point of difference between the panel and NASA is that NASA projected a usable life of the space shuttle to 2012, and we said that's not realistic. You're going to still be using that vehicle up to 2020, and you ought to be thinking about making investments in that time frame, not the 2012 time frame. So if NASA would, if at the end of this investigation, if they would come out and say, yeah, well, we think in reality this vehicle is going to be with us till 2020, and that we've got to evaluate our investments in that context. If they were to do that, I think they would find that many of the things that they have said up to now they couldn't do, they would find would make sense to do. And that, from our perspective, would be a sound decision and very good news.
John Stewart, you've been good to give us your time today. As you mentioned, we know you're very busy.
Yes. Okay. Well, I think it's important that we try and talk sensibly about this, and you guys on Talk of the Nation always try to do that. So three cheers.
Thanks very much.
Right. Bye.
John Stewart is a former member of the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel. He was with us by phone from his office in Knoxville, Tennessee. Joining us now from member station WBUR in Boston is Andrew Chaikin, space historian, most famous for his book, A Man on the Moon. And thanks very much for joining us again, Andrew.
You're welcome, Neil. Thanks for having me.
You've had a couple of days now to reflect on this tragedy. What are your thoughts now?
Well, I think in a broad sense that this is on a continuum with the shock that we got after 9/11. And without trying to stretch this too much, what I'm saying is that 9/11 woke us up to the reality of deadly risk in our day-to-day lives, and we accepted that risk because to not do so would have been to give up too much. To me, space exploration is just on the other end of a continuum of risk. We accept a certain amount of risk in order to explore the heavens, and that's not about our daily lives, it's about the life of the human species. So I think that the time is right for us to have a national conversation on space. I think if anything good can come out of this tragedy, it is that we look at what we want to accomplish as a nation. If we believe in the value of space exploration, and I think many people in this country do, it's time for us to have that conversation about the best way to use our limited resources to make that happen.
Let's get listeners back involved. Our next caller is Ivo, who joins us from Innsbruck in Austria.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello. I am a physicist, an engineer, and a former collaborator of European Space Agency. Yesterday, there was in the briefing mentioned that formerly already a piece of insulation came off on an earlier flight. Is that correct? I remember that.
Yes, I believe that is correct. That's certainly what they said in the briefing yesterday.
Was there any possibility of preventing such an event happening again?
Andrew Chaikin?
Yeah, as I understand it, I made some phone calls about that, and as I understand it, it's a pretty common occurrence. It happens because water gets in underneath that insulation, and actually there is bacterial growth that can contribute to the debonding, so to speak, of the insulation, and it can then come loose. However, as we heard in...
We should point out the shuttle sits out on that launch pad for sometimes weeks before launch, and obviously it rains.
That's right, and however, as we heard in the briefings over the weekend, you know, they've had incidences like this, and, for example, a piece of the insulation hit one of the windows of the shuttle, but it did nothing more than cause some streaks.
Yep.
So, you know, I want to emphasize something here, which is that the shuttle has never been a routine, quote-unquote, operational vehicle. It has always been what you would call an experimental vehicle, even though we've had amazing success. And by the way, there were many people who predicted after Challenger that it was only a matter of time after we had another tragedy.
Yeah.
Challenger was the 25th flight. We managed to get through almost 90 missions after Challenger before this Columbia tragedy. So I think what we need to realize is that NASA, and we could certainly talk more about this, the whole history of the shuttle program, I believe, is based on trying to do too much with too little resources.
Well, that is a question to the politicians.
Yes, indeed.
I am aware of Richard Feynman's report on the Challenger investigation, where he came back with the message that as you said, it's still a risky operation, and there is a high level of risk. But again, as you say, if the money is not there, the people cannot do their work. And I think that is a proposition to be made to the highest levels in the country, that money is available for maintaining these ships in ship shape. We have a saying in Germany which says, what does the good soldier early in the morning? The evening before, he polishes his boots. This means you have to take care of things before they become virulent.
Ivo, thanks.
That is my opinion.
And thanks very much for that piece of wisdom. We appreciate it very much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Let's go. Andrew Chaikin, I wanted to follow up on you were talking about a national dialogue about the space program. And we look at all of the public opinion polls that certainly in the aftermath of an incident like this are all very much in favor of continuing the program and very much in favor of the manned part of the program. But if as a result, could you foresee a result of a national dialogue to say, well, okay, maybe this is too dangerous. Maybe this is too much to do. Let's leave this to probes and robots and keep people here on Earth.
I don't envision that, and I desperately hope that we don't come to that conclusion. I really don't think that that's the general opinion. You can never substitute for the mind and the hands and the spirit of a human being out where no one has ever been. But I think that part of what we need to consider is the fact that we are dealing with a program that has been saddled with flawed decisions. The reason that we built the shuttle the way it is because NASA, in the era after the moon landings, had all kinds of grand plans, and the White House, the Nixon White House at that time, came back and said, we're not going to give you the money to do a base on the moon and a 50-person space station in Earth orbit and a mission to Mars. We're going to give you X amount of money. And NASA took that sum and used it to build a space shuttle. It ended up being a compromise shuttle. NASA tried to make it all things to all people. In other words, it was going to be a satellite launcher. It was going to be a retrieval for satellites. It was going to be a science platform. It was going to be for the military. You know, the reason they have those big wings on the shuttle is because they were trying to sell the shuttle to the military. And the military said, okay, we want the ability to change our landing point by thousands of miles, so we need those big wings. Well, it turned out those military missions never came to pass. I think that part of this national conversation on space is to say, let's have some decision-making that involves setting a goal in space and then making sure that NASA has the resources to accomplish that goal, whatever it is. Let's not put NASA in the position of having to do too much with too little.
We're listening to Andrew Chaikin. He's the author of A Man on the Moon. We're talking about the aftermath of the disaster that struck the space shuttle Columbia over Texas on Saturday morning. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now is former astronaut Jeff Hoffman. Hoffman served as mission specialist on four shuttles, Discovery, Atlantis, Endeavour, and Columbia. His last flight was on Columbia in 1996. He joins us by phone from his office at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge. And Jeff, good of you to join us.
Yeah, it's good to be here. And hi, Andy. We spoke just a few months ago.
Hello, Jeff. It's good to be with you.
Under sad circumstances, but yeah, it's nice to link up again.
NPR listeners may remember Jeff Hoffman's diaries. He carried a tape recorder into space for National Public Radio, and many of you will remember his observations as he circled the Earth. But Jeff, exploration, especially space travel, obviously inherently dangerous. How much of that was in your mind before a mission?
I knew that it was dangerous. Space is totally unforgiving of human mistakes and technical failures. Air travel, in the early days especially, was just like the ocean. Luckily, travel at sea and travel in the air have become much safer over the years. Ships still sink, airplanes still crash, and we're in early days of spaceflight. Yeah, it's dangerous, and we knew it. People say, how do you deal with that? And that's a very personal thing. In my own case, I guess I was always able to put those thoughts aside. I mean, I had made the decision a long time before to go, so the, you know, the time to wonder about whether it's safe is not when you're strapping in before launch. I figured, I remember my first flight. I had been dreaming of doing this since I was 6 years old. I was finally getting a chance. I wasn't going to worry about the safety. I was going to enjoy it and fully appreciate the experience, which I did.
Our next caller is Jackie, who's with us on the line from Seattle.
Yes, hi, Neil.
Hi.
I spent 20 years working for NASA on the unmanned space exploration program and also spent a year working on the space station stuff. And you know, I think a lot of what's going wrong with inside the agency has to do with how people are trained in science in general. Way back in their school days, they're trained to have this sort of arrogance about it. A good example is the group of engineers that met after the impact on the wing of this material, and their calculations concluded that they were within reasonable safety margins. However, then the scientific arrogance takes over, where you then don't even point your telescope there to take a look. You don't have the people in the space station take a look to confirm it. And I've seen time and time again plenty of examples where if you go out and take a look and use your senses, use your eyes, use your hands, it doesn't always match what's on paper. This is a pervasive problem in the way science is practiced. And another disturbing issue, too, is the fact that a lot of what NASA does in the manned program is for show, to try to get public opinion behind them. And the fact that they had so many people on board, and this was an issue with the Challenger as another example, you don't need seven people to fly these missions. Two would have been enough, but you had a multiracial crew, an international crew. It looks really good. These are some disturbing probing questions that I hope people are going to start asking.
Hmm. Good points. We just have a minute or so left in the segment. Andrew Chaikin, I wondered if you wanted to take a shot at that question.
Well, actually, I'd like to hand it over to Jeff and hear what he has to say, because
yeah,
I mean,
I think that there's two important things. The first is it's totally inappropriate to speculate on how decisions were made until we know. I don't know what the engineers were saying. You don't know, and we shouldn't be speculating. That is counterproductive. As far as why there were seven people on board, this was a scientific mission. There were two pilots on board to fly the shuttle, and there were the other people on board acting as scientists to conduct laboratory experiments. And you need to understand that when you comment on why people are up there.
Sure. It's really important, though, to look at how much work they had assigned in the given period of time.
They were working 24 hours a day on two shifts and were incredibly busy.
Jackie, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We're going to have more with Jeff Hoffman and Andrew Chaikin. We're also going to be joined by another former astronaut after we come back from the break. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're continuing our coverage of the Columbia disaster. With us by phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is former shuttle astronaut Jeff Hoffman. And with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston is Andrew Chaikin, a space historian and writer. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255 and your emails, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go to Rob, who's with us from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Let me say, first of all, I'm honored to be in such august company today, Mr. Chaikin. Your writings are fantastic, and Commander Hoffman, I did indeed get to hear your diaries on NPR, and they're quite an inspiration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My question or comment is multi-part, and I hope you can bear with me for a moment. I'm concerned about the future of the space program. While I understand that we do have to investigate this tragedy, has any thought been given by NASA or any of the administration to possibly reactivating the X-33 proof-of-concept vehicle for the Venture Star program? This may be an odd aside. Has anyone considered possibly checking on the use of the out-of-use Russian Buran space vehicles, of which I believe three flight test vehicles are still operable, or at least sitting in shelter somewhere?
Weren't they known as the shuttle skis?
They were indeed. A completely different design bureau that arrived at pretty much the same idea. And then the X-36 crew return vehicle, which was canceled by this particular administration, which had undergone several flight tests, and their ballistic chute was even proved to be useful, and then they just canceled it for, I don't know, lack of interest or lack of funds, which, as I understand, would be really the only way we could return all seven of those astronauts if there were some type of damage that would prevent the orbiter from reentering.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can tackle that one, Neil.
Okay.
Let me take the Buran shuttle first. I'm not sure that the Soviet shuttles, the former Soviet shuttles, are in any condition to fly, or if that would even be the best option.
I think you're correct on that, Andy. I mean, one of them ended up in an amusement park, and the others have not been maintained in flight status.
And the other craft he mentioned, the X-33, represents a proof-of-concept program to demonstrate what is called single-stage to orbit. Now, that has been sort of a holy grail of space designers for years, the idea that you could build a one-piece reusable spaceship. However, I think that the emerging wisdom is that that is not really attainable, and we should be focusing on a different design that perhaps uses two or perhaps three completely reusable pieces. The X-38 program, which was the crew return vehicle for the station, would in fact solve one of the problems that the space station is facing, which is this. We can't do the kind of science on the station that it's designed to do until we get a full six or seven people up there. And the Soviet Soyuz capsules that are attached to the station can only carry three people at a time. So that would solve the problem of allowing the extra crew space. It still wouldn't solve the problem of getting people up to the station if we didn't have space shuttles. So clearly, what's on our plate is to consider how to replace the shuttle, if not later than sooner.
Good questions, Rob. Thanks very much.
By the way, I'd like to point out something. We talk about the space shuttle's achievements. Jeff was part of the mission that I consider the shuttle's finest hour, which was the repair of the Hubble Space Telescope in 1993. The Hubble happened to be launched by the shuttle, but even if it had been launched by some other means, it still would have had to be repaired by astronauts. And Jeff and his colleague, Story Musgrave, and several other astronauts carried out some spacewalks to fix that telescope that were among the most demanding and most mind-boggling achievements that I think astronauts have ever made in space.
Well, with that, Andrew Chaikin, we're going to thank you very much for your time and let you get back to your regular work. Thanks very much. We appreciate it, as always.
Thank you, Neil. Words, Andy.
You bet, Jeff.
Andrew Chaikin with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Joining us now from the studios of WPSU at Pennsylvania State University, University Park, Pennsylvania, is Jim Pawelczyk. He served as payload specialist in 1998, also aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia, and thanks very much for being with us.
Good afternoon, Neil. Great to be here.
I wanted to ask both you and Jeff Hoffman, as both people who've flown aboard this particular orbiter, was it special? Was it unique? Jeff Hoffman, you've been on four.
I've flown four different orbiters, twice on Columbia. From the inside, not really. They're, by design, they're all kept as similar as possible for training purposes. That makes it a lot easier. Columbia is a bit heavier, which is why it has not been used for space station construction missions, and it has concentrated more on Hubble repair and on scientific missions like the one Jim flew on. Great old ship. You know, it was the first shuttle, and you sort of feel a bond for all of the ships you fly on. After you get back on the ground, you get out and you look at this incredible machine that not only kept you alive in space, but allowed you to do an awful lot of useful work. Of course, we missed the crew and we missed the craft.
Jim, I've read the Columbia was a bit of a hangar queen, but once up, a pleasure to fly.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't know that we could agree with the characterization of hangar queen.
No, 28 times. That's not a hangar queen.
Jeff's absolutely right that it's the oldest of the vehicles, and was a little bit heavier because it was originally instrumented a little bit more to characterize the vehicle in the early stages of the shuttle program. But once in flight, a great performer. The shuttles over the years have gone through a number of upgrades, and the Columbia went through an extensive down period a couple of years ago, basically a flip-flop of the airlock, give a little bit more space up on the mid-deck, and then a major rework up in the cockpit to move from the old analog gauges that we've seen in days of old to these multifunction, more glass cockpit type of displays.
Let's get back to the listeners. Hugh's on the line with us from Oakland, California.
Yes, hi. I'm calling about some of the budget issues that NASA has, and wondering if you all can give us a picture from the inside, if you, you know, in a general way. I grew up in a NASA family. My father worked at NASA headquarters for a number of years, and then in Europe, liaisoning with the European Space Agency and whatnot. I always had the experience that being NASA being the smallest agency in the federal government, I believe that's true, was always pinched in some way budget-wise. A lot of it was split between manned and unmanned programs. There's some people in space exploration that believe in one or the other when perhaps both are needed. And invariably, when there's government cuts what NASA would like to be doing, those two areas seem to go at one another as far as which programs will be cut. And also the influence that the Department of Defense has on NASA. I'm curious about how many of the programs or projects that the shuttle runs are devoted towards DoD projects versus general exploration. And finally, and I'm sorry if I'm overloading you with questions, but I'm curious whether NASA, I hear that there's some educational division of NASA now, and I was always surprised they didn't do something sooner because it has so much implication for the future of science and technology and really industry in our country. And we used to have, loads of pictures from satellites that would be relating planetary, observations and pictures, mm-hmm. And just things that it would seem to be would make it easy for NASA to expose some of these projects that we don't normally hear about in the media to students would really interest them as an educational ambassador type of program. And I'm sorry if I had so many questions.
Okay.
Fill me in.
Let me just say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And why don't we try to get some answers to that? Jim, you're there now. Can you talk about the pressures on the budget area?
Sure. Let me take a stab at a few of those, and I'll take them in a little bit of reverse order. So if we begin with the educational component, I think what the caller is referring to is a recent initiative to come back to mission specialist educators, educator astronauts, and that's a relatively recent program with the hiring of Barbara Morgan, I believe, in about 1997, if I'm correct. And just recently, we've had a call go out, had over 6 million hits, even before Saturday, people interested in nominating for that program. But there's always been an education division at NASA, and it's been very, very busy and effective throughout the shuttle era. So we're seeing always K-12 downlinks. On my mission, we did a number of downlinks with universities around the country, as well as parallel experiments that were available to grade school students. And, you know, that's nothing unique to that mission. That happens all the time. With regard to the budget, if you ask anybody about their budget, they always want more. And you look at what's happened with NASA over the years, you look in the height of the Apollo era, you know, it was roughly 6% of the federal budget. Now it's under 1% of the federal budget. But in terms of absolute dollars, if you look at the probably low point at about the 1981-82 era, it's been on a a slow but slightly steady climb. Are there big agenda items out there? Absolutely they are, and I think that just underscores the issue that this is an important and vital federal agency, and it really does serve an important job of not only developing new technology but inspiring that next generation.
Jeff Hoffman, what about the influence of the Defense Department?
As Andy Chaikin mentioned earlier, the desire to be able to launch Defense Department satellites certainly did play a significant role in the physical design of the shuttle. But after the Challenger accident, the DoD joined the commercial satellite launchers in removing their payloads from the shuttle. And the shuttle is no longer used to launch either commercial satellites or DoD satellites. There are, I mean, if the DoD, like from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects group, wants to sponsor scientific research on the shuttle or on the station, it has done that. It does it openly, not secretly, mm-hmm. Just like any other research and development organization.
Let's see if we get a final question from David, who's with us in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
Well, actually, I'm passing through Benton Harbor. Good morning, gentlemen.
Well, good afternoon here, but go ahead.
It's really a question slash statement directed at Jim and Jeff. First, a quick opinion. I'm not a scientist. I'm just an average American citizen. In my opinion, our space program is absolutely imperative and must go on. The reason that I felt compelled to call in was listening to the other caller earlier, Jackie. I'm involved in the world of auto sports, professional auto sports. I'm not a car driver. I'm in the business side of it. We went through a similar incident a couple of years ago. We lost one of our greatest stars, Dale Earnhardt. There was a tremendous amount of hand-wringing throughout the country at how dangerous auto racing had become, and because of this singular death, that auto racing should be banned. In my opinion, the hand-wringing, and I hope I don't offend anybody this, over the loss of these seven lives is out of control. These lives need to be celebrated, let's not end the program. I'm certain that these seven people would not want a space program brought to a halt over their loss of life, over something that they absolutely love to do. And it just, I find it very irritating when all of a sudden mass media, and I'm not saying NPR, and Americans in general kind of start wringing their hands and saying, oh my gosh, this is too dangerous, we have to stop doing it.
Well, I think what you say is very much mirrors the way astronauts feel about what they do. It does have dangers, we recognize it, and none of the people who died on Saturday would want the program to be stopped because of an accident.
I'm afraid we're going to have to take that as the last word. Jeff Hoffman, thanks very much.
It's always a pleasure to come and work with NPR.
Jim Pawelczyk, thanks to you too.
You're very welcome.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.